find out about traditional music from Peru. This is produced and presented by Jürgen Lindemark. It's broadcast twice on Channel 292 Germany, 9670 at 10 and 14 UT, February.
You're listening to WGXC, Accra, 90.7 FM.
The UK duo 6 and 8 applies a formula of lush atmospherics and throaty poetry that adds up to a provocative mix. And we'll hear a track on the next Deep Threes. Plus, music from the Torque Trio, Art Sonic, and Red Dawn. Deep Threes, where will the music take you?
Hello, WGXC listeners. This is Matthew Winnie Harrington, assistant member of WGXE Radio Group. Camp Hill Hudson is hosting monthly community dinner on Tuesday, February 6th at 5:30 p.m. in Solaris Building, 360 Warren Street. Come experience community, meet new people and old friends over a freshly prepared meal made by local volunteers. Everyone is invited and no one will come turn away. We will be glad to see you there. Please bring a friend.
WGXE underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, where membership provides access to world-class cinema, first-run feature films, art house films, live music, and more, plus advance notice of close-up series conversations with directors and actors and other special events at the Star Theater in Rhinebeck, the Orpheum in Saugerties, and traveling around the Hudson Valley. Information at upstatefilms.org. That's upstatefilms.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Brouwer Propulsion Laboratory in Brooklyn, New York. WGXC local business supporters help us continue to be a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement. Thank you, Brouwer Propulsion Laboratory.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Tiffany Greenwald Simon reports at HudsonValley360.com that the Columbia County Board of Supervisors County Government Committee wants to spend up to $350,000 to replace security cameras at several county buildings. The security camera replacements would be in Hudson, at the Columbia County Courthouse at 401 Union Street, the Department of Social Services, 25 Railroad Avenue, the Columbia County Department of Health, 325 Columbia Street, the Columbia County Department of Motor Vehicles, 560 Warren Street, the Columbia County Treasurer's Office, 50 North 6th Street, Columbia County Offices at 401 State Street, the Columbia County Solid Waste Department, 51 Newman Road, and 11 Warren Street, recently purchased from Galvin Foundation. The new cameras would also read license plates and include facial recognition readers. Michael Chimides, Hudson's third ward supervisor, asked for more privacy guarantees, saying, and I quote, "What you're describing is not binding. That's why I want a policy. I can then go to my constituents and say, we're putting up these cameras, it's about security, and it's still about your privacy," end quote. Then the board approved buying the equipment, with Columbia County Board of Supervisors Chair Matt Murrell recommending that the cameras do not go live until the board creates a privacy policy. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Brendan J. Lyons reports in the Times Union that Governor Kathy Hochul's appointment, Stephen G. James, started as superintendent of the state police on January 31st and immediately replaced many of the agency's top leaders. Lieutenant Colonel Christopher R. West, an assistant deputy superintendent, was named first deputy superintendent.
James also appointed 7 new deputy superintendents, including in the Professional Standards Bureau, Field Command, Bureau of Criminal Investigation, Employee Relations, and Counterterrorism Unit. He cleared out Colonel Daniel J. Cooney, a deputy superintendent of Field Command, Colonel Robert G. Gregory, who had been deputy superintendent for administration, Colonel George K. Nohide, deputy superintendent of employee relations, and Lieutenant Colonel Jennifer H. Gottstein, an assistant superintendent of employee relations, to make way for the new hires. Hochul said of her new appointment, and I quote, "This will be our opportunity to lead a new generation. There's very few who have the experience Stephen brings to this job," end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Abby Stanley reports for News 10 that Catskill High School students Madison Mudge, 11th grade, and Molly Oswald, 12th grade, will give vocal performances later this month at Carnegie Hall in Manhattan for the 2024 High School Honors Performance Series. Oswald performs with the mixed choir directed by Dr. Jeffrey Ames of Belmont University, and Mudge performs with the treble choir directed by Matthew Brady from the University of Miami. Both students also participated in the program last year. The two performances are open to the public on February 10th. Tickets are available through the Carnegie Hall box office. And you can read more about this story at the News 10 website. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
To avoid a wider war, ceasefire now in Gaza. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. On Tuesday, President Biden addressed the press while boarding the presidential helicopter, saying,
"I don't think we need a wider war in the Middle East. That's not what I'm looking for."
But a wider war is exactly what Biden's inflaming, with unreserved support for Israel's ongoing annihilation of Gaza and the 2.3 million Palestinians trapped there. Demands for an immediate ceasefire are growing, and despite promises of indefinite war from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the United States, as Israel's principal weapons provider, could shut down the bombardment with one phone call. Absent that, the widening war that Biden hopes to avoid seems ever more possible. Potential escalation was recently triggered by the killing of 3 U.S. Army reservists stationed at a base called Tower 22 in the Jordanian desert, near the Syrian and Iraqi borders. It houses approximately 350 U.S. Army and Air Force personnel. Together with another U.S. military garrison called Al-Tanf, about 20 kilometers to the north in Syria, these remote outposts are part of the U.S. military presence to counter the Islamic State. Early on Sunday, January 28th, a drone was able to penetrate the base's defenses, attacking the soldiers in their sleeping quarters. The 3 soldiers killed were Sergeant William Rivers, 46, Specialist Kennedy Sanders, 24, and Specialist Brianna Moffitt, 23. All 3 were from Georgia and were African American. An estimated 40 others were injured in the blast. Calls in the United States for swift reprisals grow, including demands that President Biden attack Iran. Pundits are quick to point out we're in an election year, and thus President Biden can't let himself be perceived as a weak military leader. Target Tehran, Republican Texas Senator John Cornyn said on social media, joined by fellow Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, stating, "The only thing the Iranian regime understands is force," unquote, and demanding the president, quote, "hit them now and hit them hard," unquote. But not everyone's demanding vengeance. Perhaps most powerfully and poignantly, the parents of one of the fallen soldiers. Moffat's parents said they hope there's no escalation in violence that kills more American troops, the Associated Press reported. Francine Moffat, the mother of Breonna Moffat, told the Associated Press Monday, quote, "I just hope and pray no other family has to go through this. It takes your heart and your soul," she said. In addition to the intense assault on Gaza that followed Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, military strikes have occurred across the wider Middle East. Israel and Hezbollah have exchanged artillery fire along the Lebanon-Israel border, claiming lives on both sides. Houthi rebels in Yemen have hit cargo vessels headed to or otherwise connected to Israel, the U.S., or the U.K. in the Gulf of Aden, and hijacked at least one vessel, disrupting international shipping through the vital Suez Canal. In response, the U.S. has launched multiple missile and artillery strikes on Yemen. Iran has hit targets in Iraq, Pakistan, and Syria. Adding to the volatility, Turkey has been stepping up its attacks on U.S.-allied Kurdish forces in Syria and Iraq.
There were about 60 attacks by these Iraqi militias against U.S. troops and bases during the first 2.5 years of Biden's presidency.
Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, the Iranian-American expert on Iran continued,
"Since October 17th, however, when Israel went into Gaza, there's been more than 160 attacks just in these last 100 days. At some point, one of those attacks was going to kill Americans. And the president essentially accepted this risk, continue to allow Israel to bombard Gaza, in his own words, indiscriminately, knowing very well that the game of statistics was simply such that at some point the Iraqi militias would succeed and Americans would die. Now we are in that situation. Instead of raising questions about this entire strategy as to why we are putting U.S. troops at risk in order for Israel to continue to indiscriminately bomb and kill and slaughter people in Gaza."
Spencer Ackerman, foreign policy columnist for The Nation, shares Parsi's concerns.
"The United States, while it might say that it's seeking to contain the conflict, is caught up in the logic of escalation."
Ackerman said on Democracy Now!,
"These are the accumulations of choices that Biden and his team are making to involve the U.S. more deeply in this spiraling conflict, all of which could be stopped if the United States used its immense influence over Israel."
Polls show a majority of Americans support a ceasefire in Gaza. Scores of cities have passed ceasefire resolutions, most recently Chicago. The Biden administration, though, appears resolute in backing Israel's military assault on Gaza, with its continued supply of weapons, despite the International Court of Justice's recent provisional finding that Israel may be committing genocide. Ceasefire and diplomacy, not arms and diplomatic cover, leading to an end to Israel's occupation of Palestine, is the only solution. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And now, here is your WGXC Weekend Weather Report. On Sunday, it'll be sunny with a temperature high near 38 degrees and a north wind at 7 to 9 miles per hour. And on Sunday night, it will be mostly clear with a temperature low of around 23 degrees. And on Monday, it will be sunny with a temperature high near 36 degrees. And that is your Weekend Weather Report from WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
Tuesday is lobby day at the state capitol. In this report, we cover two rallies on January 29th. The first, by 1199 and home healthcare workers, called for the Home Care Savings and Reinvestment Act. This law would save the state's Medicaid program approximately $2.5 billion a year by directly paying for home care services rather than paying a flat per month per member rate to manage care plans to coordinate services. We hear from Assembly members Sarah Clark, Jeff Dinowitz, and Harvey Epstein, and Senator May. And then before a rally for the Climate Superfund Act, we talk with Anshul Gupta. Research and Policy Director of Clean Power in New York. Then Blair Horner of NYPERG introduces the lead sponsor of the Superfund Act, Assemblymember Jeff Dinowitz.
We know this is two-pronged. This is both about raising wages, making sure that the billions of dollars that we put into health care is going to those who care for New Yorkers and those New Yorkers who need care. That's where the money needs to go. We know that this isn't just about caring for New Yorkers, allowing them to live in their homes independently, allowing them to have control over their lives, their care, and making sure they get to do what they need to do every day to live the life that they deserve to live. But this is also about pulling families out of poverty. In Rochester alone, we know that most of our home care workers are single mom, head of household. And if we raise wages out of poverty, we will do two things. We will take care of New Yorkers, and we will raise people out of poverty and give them living wages to ensure they can take care of their families and become the amazing people that we already know they are and pay them what they're worth. It is time to change the system. It is time to take the middleman out of the equation and put the dollars into care and put the dollars into wages. We can do this. We have a plan. We know our healthcare chairs are on board. Let's get it done this year.
I'm Assemblyman Jeffrey Dinowitz, and I represent part of Bronx. It's really very simple. We want to accomplish two things. We want to treat our older adults, those who are disabled. We want to treat them right. We want to be able to keep them at home. But we also want to make sure that the people who are making sure that they are living comfortably get paid the wages that they deserve. We should not be cutting wages, that's for sure. We should be raising wages. So this legislation does both. We protect our workers and we protect the people that they are trying to make sure live a good life at home. And it is very important that we come together as a coalition, labor, and all the advocates for older people to ensure that we get this done.
Harvey Epstein.
Struggles of home health care workers. We know how underpaid they are. We know that we continue to put money in the budget year after year after year to ensure that our people who need home health care workers and the workers themselves get a livable salary. But we have this problem, this systemic structural problem that we have to fix. That the money we're allocating is not getting to the workers. There's this middle entity that is sucking resources from the system. And we need to stop that, because unless we ensure that the workers get the money that they need, unless we mandate that it gets down to those workers, the people who rely on home health care workers aren't going to get the support that they need. We have an opportunity right now to recapture billions of dollars to ensure that we pay people well, so we have more healthcare workers in the system and we support the communities in need.
Rachel May, I represent Syracuse. 2 years ago, we fought for the largest investment in home care wages any state had ever made. But then we found out that the agencies that provided the home care were having to negotiate contracts with sometimes dozens of different insurance companies. The contracts were proprietary. We were not allowed to know what those contracts looked like, and the agencies weren't allowed to tell us. So we had no way to do the oversight to make sure that the money taxpayers had put in the budget to support home care workers and their clients, we had no way to make sure that money was going where it was supposed to go. This bill we'll change that.
My name is Anshul Gupta. I'm the Policy and Research Director for New Yorkers for Clean Power, and I am in the New York State Capitol today to advocate for three bills, the Green Transit, Green Jobs Bill, the Climate Superfund Act, and the New York Heat Act. Two of these bills, the Green Transit, Green Jobs, and the New York Heat, they address the top two climate polluting segments of New York State's economy, the buildings, and the transportation sectors, which together account for 2/3 of our greenhouse gas emissions and also create tons of just air pollution, both indoor, outdoor pollution that disproportionately impacts denser neighborhoods, communities of color, low-income neighborhoods. And we need to electrify both these sectors, and I'm here to advocate for those.
Now, of course, the governor did put a good part of the New York Heat Act into the state budget, but do you get the sense that the state is moving quick enough at this point to, you know, actually decarbonize the state and transition to a clean energy future?
I believe we can do a lot better. I think we are behind, falling a little bit behind our climate goals. We need to sort of pick up the pace of decarbonizing our buildings and transportation sectors. The governor also favors a cap and invest program to help decarbonize the state's economy, but in order for that program to be successful, we need to take legislative and regulatory actions to reduce emissions. We can't put the entire burden of decarbonizing the economy on the cap and invest program, and it looks like it's going to start with a fairly low carbon price. So in and by itself, the cap and invest program will not come anywhere close to meeting the climate laws targets, and we do need to take bold legislative action, like passing the Green Transit, Green Jobs bill, which will help decarbonize the public transportation sector, New York Heat Act, which will start, hopefully start the process of getting New York State's buildings off of super climate pollutant methane gas.
We next hear from Blair Horner of NYPERG, the lead group sponsoring the Climate Super Fund Act. The act would require companies that have contributed significantly to the buildup of climate warming greenhouse gases to bear a share of the cost of needed infrastructure investments to adapt to climate change.
And we're here to have a news conference today urging that the Climate Superfund Act be included in the budget, in the final budget that's agreed to, hopefully by the end of March. First speaker will be a sponsor of the bill and the assembly, Assemblymember Jeff Dinowitz.
There is nothing I can think of that would save more lives than passing this and doing the job that we have to do. You know, when I think about what's going on just in the past few years in New York City, when I think of the fact that just a year and a half ago, the major Deegan Expressway was flooded this high. It never, ever happened before. The fact that we have more hurricanes in the United States, more tornadoes, and more severe hurricanes and tornadoes, more wildfires, more everything, more extreme weather. Climate change means severe weather, and it's getting worse all the time. 100-year storms happening every year and more than once a year. This legislation would hold the fossil fuel companies that are the main cause of climate change responsible for paying part of the cost. No one is even suggesting that they pay for the whole cost. All of those companies have been making record high profits. The past year, the past 2 years, profits like you can't believe. And those profits are being made on the backs of all the people on the planet. They're making a killing, and at the same time, it's killing people. So they ought to pay for part of the cost. I think they should pay for the whole cost, but they should pay to help clean up the mess that they created. And the legislation is very straightforward. It apportions responsibility based on ascertainable facts that exist, so we know how much they should pay. And it won't be a tax on people, it'll be an assessment on the oil companies. And if they don't pay, you know who's going to pay? Who's going to pay?
We are.
Why should we pay for the entire cost of the mess they created? And as we've all been saying now for quite a while, when you make a mess, you got to clean it up. That's what my mom told me. You make a mess, you got to clean it up.
This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
No more war, ceasefires will be fighting for. No more weapons, no more war, ceasefires will be fighting for.
No more war, ceasefires will be fighting for.
No more weapons, no more war, ceasefires will be fighting for.
No more war, ceasefires will be fighting for.
All right, Tuesday at
at 6 p.m., Leo Biden Federal Building, 1 Clinton Square,
4 o'clock.
So Tuesday, February 6th at 4 p.m. at the O'Brien Federal Building, 1 Clinton Square. Please bring your pots and pans, and please bring your bodies and endorsements and statements. We're going to have a rally.
Yo, this is Willie Terry Roman, labor correspondent, outside of the Troy Plaza, where there's a rally going on in support of Palestine. And I have, as my guest, one of the organizers here. His name is?
My name is Ian El-Karabi.
Right, how you doing, Ian?
I'm doing well.
All right. So, Ian, tell me something about what's going on.
Huh? Can you repeat that question?
Oh, tell me what's going on here today.
So right now, Troy for Black Lives is organizing an amazing event. A lot of folks were doing an amazing event. We're out here weekly, monthly, yearly. For the past 10 to 15 years, we've been doing a lot of organizing for Palestine. I'm grateful, eternally grateful that, you know, Troy's for Black Lives and Jewish Voice for Peace has been helping out. You know, particularly Zahair and I have been to every one, and we've been organizing a lot of them. So we would love for more people to show up to stuff, particularly Monday and Tuesday. Monday, Albany High School are staging a walkout, and Tuesday, in front of the Leo O'Brien Federal Building, we're having a rally, march, potential speak out across from the Palace Theater to talk about UNRWA and ceasefire.
Oh, okay. And I have somebody here because Black Lives Matter. Troy for Black Lives.
Alfonso?
Trying to get the Alfonso. Okay.
About why Troy for Black Lives is sponsoring this event?
You can do it.
Okay, I'm getting somebody from Troy for Black Lives.
Okay, what was
the question? And I have as my guest, your name?
Alfonso Rodriguez.
Okay, and you have Troy for Black Lives?
Yes, I am. I'm a member of Troy for Black Lives.
So tell me, why should black people, or why should people in general, be supporting this struggle that's going on?
Well, I think it's important to remember that these folks in Palestine have been under siege, under attack, under occupation for 75 years now. And that these recent spat of like conflicts and things didn't start with October 7th. This is a regime of folks. Israel is a regime of folks who have been occupying and setting up an apartheid state in Palestine. And that's something that black folks here in the States and all over the world really have some kind of association with. There's a familiarity there with it because we also are a part of various, a myriad states, either apartheid states or, you know, racism here in the States, or just other forms of state-sanctioned violence that happens. And when you start to peel back the layers of the onion, you see the connections between the settler colonial projects that exist in Israel today that tie back to the original, or one of the original settler colonial projects that is the United States.
Well, Israel supported South Africa in the apartheid regime, so I guess that's the reason why South Africa really came out and took them to court.
For sure. I mean, Israel helped support the apartheid state, but there's the coalition, the organizers, roots on the ground folks who've done the work and they've studied and now become those lawyers that you see in the ICJ case, right? So it's interesting to see how folks on the ground who have been affected in the past are now starting to become those revolutionaries and those people who are affecting the change and now, in the here, in the now, and in the future.
Now, even if on October 7th, 170 people got killed in Israel. That's what they say. And there's a lot of discussion going on and debate going on about that,
right,
you
right.
know, because of the propaganda that Israel have.
Right.
But there is no justification for killing 27,000 people and over 10,000 kids, right?
There is none. You hear so many quotes about, oh, we have the right to defend ourselves. We have the right to respond. But when you look at just like the proportion of the response, I mean, you don't want, like, every life is sacred, right? But the wanton destruction of cultural sites, buildings,